Hey folks, Sam Jones here, and before we get started, I just wanted to mention that with the holidays upon us, it's a great time to visit the Off-Camera Store. If you haven't taken the time to check it out, you'll find that in addition to being a podcast and a television show, we make this beautiful limited edition magazine, and we deliver it right to your door. So if you're feeling like giving a really unique gift this year, or if you just want something cool at your own house, go to the Off-Camera Store, check out all the magazines, and maybe pick up a premium subscription. That's 12 issues of inspiration right to your doorstep. And it's not only a great gift, but it's a great way to support the show. And best of all, everything in the store is 15% off for the entire month of December if you just use the offer code SANTA. So don't give someone a crappy gift card that they'll lose or forget about. Take a moment, check out the store, and give someone the gift that keeps on giving. Creativity, inspiration, and some pretty cool photos delivered right to your door. So that's my spiel for today, and now on to the main event. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with writer, producer, and beloved network television creator, Bill Lawrence. If you haven't heard of Bill Lawrence, I can guarantee you've seen his work if you've been anywhere near a television set in the last 20 years. He's had a hand as either a creator, writer, or producer of some of our most widely watched comedies, including Friends, Spin City, Scrubs, Cougar Town, and the fourth wall breaking Undateable. And the thing that's really amazing and annoying about Bill is that he became successful at such a young age, going from stand-up comic to script writing to show running to creating and producing. And by his mid-20s, he had created and was running Spin City. I mean, talk about meteoric career ascension. I've known Bill for a while now. And by a while, I mean we used to play basketball at the YMCA in Hollywood in 1992. And I thought he was just a cocky, brash, decent ball player. But as it turns out, while I was figuring out how to take a picture, Bill was telling Michael J. Fox how to deliver a joke. And as I've gotten to know Bill over the years, he garners more and more of my respect. Bill has this confidence that each decision he makes is right. And if not, he has the same amount of confidence that the next decision will be right. And despite having reached a very comfortable and successful point in his career, he continues to push himself to take artistic risks. If you are an aspiring writer, or television creator, or comic, or if you're just interested in the inner workings of the entertainment business, you're going to want to stick around for this one. Bill's here to give us a hysterical crash course on finding an agent, a tour of the writer's room, a lesson on pitching shows, and one of the best examples I've heard about how to circumvent the network marketing system. All hilariously told by a guy whose whole Hollywood career plays like a send-up of the business itself. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Sam. How you doing, bud?
Good. Thanks for doing this. We first crossed paths at the YMCA in probably 1992. And, you know, when you're playing basketball at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, you just assume, like, you're playing with a bunch of guys who either don't have any work or they're actors or trying to be actors. And I was a struggling photographer at the time, and so I was always available at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. And I'd see you occasionally, and I had no idea that you were on your path to this uber successful, you know, TV career. And you know, just for people who don't know, you've had this amazing success. You started out as a writer on shows like Friends and The Nanny. You, at 26, created Spin City.
I did. I got very lucky. I had a great mentor.
And you went on to do Scrubs and Cougar Town and now Undateable and Rush Hour. So you've had three shows that have gone over 100 episodes, which is amazing, and you're still boyishly handsome.
Very boyishly handsome. I have nice bangs.
I try
to wear my hair very bang. You know, I always think about that basketball game. You can track people from that game that you still cross paths with or see that they're doing well. There's the guy that created the shield was in that game. Tim Hobart, who runs the middle. George Clooney. I remember I had a conversation. It's a name drop with George Clooney in that game, and it was right when both of our careers were we were complaining. It's a true story, and we had both just gotten jobs, and he said, "My career is so goofy that I just got a job in a pilot. It's the second TV show I've done called ER. He's like, that's not going to work because he had done a sitcom called ER like eight
You're
years
kidding
earlier.
Me.
There's another show called
that.
ER with Elliot Gould. And I'm like, dude, you think that's lame? I'm on a show called Friends. It's the most generic title I've ever heard, you know? And that was literally kind of like the last week that we were both there playing ball because we were both off working, you know, a week later.
Well, you're both bastards.
And you deserve none of your success.
I want to start with a quote that I heard that you said, which I thought was such a great way to identify this industry and the way that you sort of come up in it. You said that the first thing I learned is if you don't know what you're doing, you make a decision anyway, and you can always change it if it turns out to be wrong.
Yeah. So, by the way, that works for parenting, too. I don't know if you know that.
Well, maybe it does. I hope so. I hope it does. But you know, to me, I heard that, and I thought, that really sort of explains a lot about this industry.
Yeah, I think that television specifically, but I imagine a lot of entertainment, is a fear-driven business. You know, a lot of people... their jobs are to second guess, you know, and to be worried, is this going to work? Are people going to like this character? Does this show have universal appeal? What I recognized early on, people that came to big decisions with any air of insecurity or being unsure, they immediately got devoured. You know, because the powers that be, not because they're evil, but because they have a lot of at stake too, would sense that insecurity. And immediately, you know, when you hear about the notes process or shows changing, you know, well, then maybe she shouldn't be single. Maybe she should be married. Maybe she should have a baby. Maybe people like kids. And you'd see things change. And one of the first lessons I ever learned from this guy, Gary Goldberg, he passed away recently. He's the guy I created Spin City with, and he's a famous... created Family Ties and Brooklyn Bridge. And I saw it early on a show I worked with him, and he said, has to be this guy. You cast a guest actor. You know, it has to be this guy. He's perfect for it. He's great. And then we watched a rehearsal, and Gary to me is like, this guy stinks. And, you know, and I'm like, what are you going to do? He's like, well, I'm going to fire him, and then I'm going to say it has to be somebody else, you know, with the same conviction and the same passion, you know, because... You make a decision, but when you make a decision, you have to make it full on. You believe it 100%. You're the leader. You want everybody to believe it with you. And if it doesn't work, you can't be a chicken shit. You have to say, hey, I was wrong on that one, but I'm 100% sure with all my conviction that this decision's correct.
I talk sometimes about this idea of developing your hustle, and then in the beginning, it feels like you're hustling almost, or you're faking it, and then those things become true and they become a part of you.
It's also when you're young. There's so many stories of young men and women that were lucky enough, you know, or talented enough to find themselves in positions of power at a very young age, and you know, and there's you know, because it was really weird in Spin City doing that at 26. It is so liberating, and you can breathe a sigh of relief. The first time that you may in your head know that you're faking it, and you know, I'm sure this script's gonna work, and then you see other people go, okay, good, and you know, that moment when they're like, they bought it, you know
right.
what I mean? And so to me, that's so empowering that you can ultimately trick yourself the same way, you know, in a good, positive way. It does become your thing.
Right, exactly. So I wanna talk about your mentor, and I also wanna talk about, I'm curious, when you were a kid, or even when you were heading into college, did you have sort of a step-by-step plan? Did you know that you wanted to be this, or know that you wanted to be a writer?
I tell my children that the greatest gift I think a young person can have, and I had it, if you have a passion and you know you want to do something at a young age, man, you're even if it never comes to fruition, to have that driving you influencing, you know, who you are and what you study and what extracurricular stuff you do is such a gift. You know, you were nice enough to, my daughter loves music. Her light will be on in their room at 2 a.m. sometimes on school nights. If she was in there watching a television show, I'd be like, what the hell are you doing? Go to bed. She's in writing songs and playing guitar, and I'll just say, yeah, stay up as long as you want. You know, we'll make it work. I wanted to be a TV writer from age 15 on, and my parents let me lean into it, which I thought was a lifesaver for me personally, being, I enjoyed fun and was a bit of a screw-up. I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to come straight to LA after high school and be try to be a TV writer or a stand-up comic. I just love those worlds. And by the way, quite honestly, once you're here, no one asks you where you went to college and no one wants to see your transcript and no one cares. That being said, so my dad sat me down and he said, here's the deal, man. If you go to college and you get a degree and you go out to LA, we'll help you as much as we possibly can. You know, if you can't make ends meet, you know, we'll help you with your rent.
Right.
And we'll support you as much as we can as you try to make it. If you go out after high school, you will have our love and emotional support. You know?
And that was smart.
I know. And I'm like, well, I should probably go to college then. So I went to college and I talked to my dad about it. I didn't really talk to him about it until my 30s. And he said, we just didn't think you were emotionally old enough to go out to LA as an 18-year-old with no one in your family west of the Mississippi. You know?
Right. Was there ever any, when you got out of college, ever any grander ambitions of, like, did they steer you away a little bit to like a novelist or?
You know, I think my mom would have loved it, man. In fact, because I went to a college of William & Mary. William & Mary is the oldest college in America, you know, and so the creative writing professors talked about the gin and tonic circuit with F. Scott Fitzgerald, and they rode three speeds to class like Mr. Chips. It was hysterical.
Right.
So my mom had that fantasy. My dad didn't. My dad just always thought Hollywood was a sham. And so the thing I used to give my dad, I used to laugh so hard is, I liked my dad's friends, but you probably had the same experience. I wasn't friends with any of them. And every 2 months or so, one of them would call me, like, you know, to chat, and then just casually offer me a job wherever they worked.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, it would always be like, hey, Bill Doug Benson. It's my dad's tennis buddy.
Sounds like, you know, the scene in The Graduate after he comes back from school.
It's 100%.
Plastics.
You know, I tried to act like my dad's not behind it. You know, I'm like, hey, Mr. Benson, what are you calling for? Oh, no reason. You know, how you doing? You know, I always thought you'd be great in the marketing department here at Pepsi. And I'd be like, tell my dad I'm fine. You know, I'm waiting tables at Gaucho Grill. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. But that, you know, I thought it was funny, you know, and sweet. But he didn't want to be caught, you know, pushing, you know. He didn't want to be the guy that told me that this was a pipe dream.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, I was thinking about that, you know, that idea of hindsight and being able to look back and identify the moment where something happened, some door opened that started you off on what you were actually going to do. And I wondered if you could identify the moment where you went from wanting to be in this industry to being in the industry.
I think there's two of them. There's one that was mortifying. I used to really entertain ideas about being a stand-up comic. Okay, and I went to a college in a tourist town. John Stewart went to William & Mary, and there's a local comedy club because Colonial Williamsburg, you know, always have these people coming through. And I always tried it and was pretty good. And I was doing it one night at a club and just getting killed, you know. And I don't mean killed like, hey, he's funny and the audiences aren't good. I just mean no one was digging me at all. And a buddy of mine, on a Sunday night, there's only like 40 people, and the club owner wasn't there. A buddy of mine said, I said, I don't know if I can go up and do this tonight, man. It's just going to hurt, you know, sting a little too much. And he's like, I know your stuff. I'll go do it. And, you know, he was a theater guy, and he went and did my material. And he didn't kill, because that would be a better story, but he certainly did exponentially better than I did, having not been a comic, with the material I had written. And so I had a really kind of an epiphany that I was like, oh, you know what? If he can go up and be funny having not even practiced with stuff, I'm a pretty good joke writer. You know, I can write this material. You know, I'm not, you know, I look at old videos of myself performing, and I used to wear a hat backwards, and people would laugh at weird times, and I didn't understand why, and it was because I was nervously spinning my hat like I was trying to screw myself into the ground. You know, so uncomfortable.
You're trying to find an exit anywhere.
How can I get off stage? So that was a real eye-opening moment for me. The other story is I got shit canned. You had a curse on this show?
Oh, yeah, you can curse.
Good. The first year of Friends, I was hired on a show. This is a really interesting thing. I hired on a show. I got to be there while you watched it become what can only happen on American TV, a huge zeitgeisty giant hit where these young people became huge celebrities overnight.
Right.
I knew I was doing well on the show because I could get a lot of jokes in, And, you know, the joke at the time amongst my friends was like, hey, you're like Matthew. I was Matthew Perry's fatter older brother and then skinnier older brother than fatter older brother. You know what I mean? Because we have similar rhythms and looks. And I got fired at the end of the first year of that show. So right when it became a huge hit, I was let go. And the reason it was such a good moment for me was it was the first time, it's like when you said when you put your work in front, I knew my work was good and knew that I was doing funny stuff and knew that I was being let go because one of the bosses and I didn't get along at my own fault. You know, I was still a dumb kid that didn't realize that, you know, it's somebody else's world and you have to behave, you know, as they want you to behave.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
So completely my fault. But knowing, you know, having that sense of, I was really, really good on that show and that's the number one show on TV, so I'm going to get hired again pretty quick. You know, so it, instead of going fetal and going, I've just ruined everything, I came out of that with a confidence and instead of negativity, having learned a lesson. And I you know, which is, right. I talk about it now. I always tell people, gotta remember, your job on a TV show is not to do what makes you laugh, it's to do what makes the showrunner laugh, you know, which is kind of a weird lesson to learn for young comics and comedians.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Because you said when you come to Hollywood, no one cares about your where you went to college or your, you know, your GPA or whatever. But they do care. I mean, you got to be able to do the work.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people in this town, they just don't, they say they're a writer, they say they're doing this, but they don't do any work.
I love that you know that. That's my, I think this is the harshest reality here. Everybody that's actually finished a script is immediately ahead of 90% of the people that claim to be writers out here. The weirdest thing about being a writer is that you can just say you are one, you know?
Right.
I can't tell you how many young people I've spoken to, they say, I'm a screenwriter. And I'll go, okay, what have you written? Nothing yet, but man, I got, you know, I got like four or five great ones right up here, man. I'm like, you're doomed, you know? Because I will tell you that every overnight success, you know, it's always bullshit, but every overnight success screenwriter, songwriter, television writer has a giant stack of scripts, pilots, plays, sketches, you know, like a huge portfolio. I mean, photographers,
sure,
painters,
sure.
You know.
Now, was that you? Did you?
I did. I started by
writing specs or original?
I wrote a ton of specs. You know what I did is my con early on was I didn't go out looking for representation until I had already written about 10 spec scripts because all of these agents think that one of the easiest things to generate money for them is to find someone that's prolific, that's fast. And so part of my scam early on was then I went to an agency and I was like, yeah, here's my two scripts. I got two spec scripts. And they're like, these are really good. Do you have anything that's more like a single camera? And I'd already written a Wonder Years script. I'm like, I like Wonder Years. You want me to give that a shot? You know? And they'd be like, yeah, yeah. I'm like, all right. Then I'd say, how long can I wait that it's not ridiculous? And 4 days later, I'd be like, here you go. You finished it already? And I'd be like, well, you know, I'm just really passionate about kind of hooking up with you. And,
yeah.
You know, so I really kind of worked through the night. This is good. I'm like, oh, cool, cool. You know, and that was my scam early on was, and literally like, hey, have you ever done in 1 hour? No, I guess I could take a shot at it, man. What do you want, like a crime thing, like a procedural or something? Yeah, sure. All right, let me do it. And you go, here's an NYPD blue. 6 days later, they'd be like, really? That fast? Like,
this yeah. guy, we got to sign this guy.
Yeah, this yeah. guy, he's just bam, 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 you know. The truth is you get experience by being on staffs, and you can only be on a staff if you're a worker, if you can write in other people's voice, okay?
Right.
You know, because you lose your gig so quickly. I can't tell you how many people have had to move on from my shows that I knew were very talented because they couldn't write that particular show. You'd get their script and you'd be like, none of these characters sound like the characters, unfortunately. They sound like the people in your amazing play that you wrote.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Which is why I hired
right,
you.
Right. But then, so what's weird is you first have to prove that you are a jack of all trades, that you can write, you know, for me, The Nanny or Friends or at the same time, you know, a drama or an edgier single camera show or Larry Sanders. And then the weird thing is if you can do that, you can work forever. But the way that you get to take a leap into your own show is then you have to have your own voice. But you work on staffs, usually.
You have to develop your voice.
Yeah, usually right. 5 to 10 years before, and then you'll be like, here's a pilot, and it doesn't sound like those. It sounds hopefully like me.
Right, you know? Right. You mentioned a little earlier your mentor, Gary Goldberg, who you wrote Spin City with. But I wondered what you think Gary saw in you that made him want to, when you were so young, partner with you on that and go through that process with you.
You know what I really liked about Gary? He was, he didn't start his, you know, he went to like 8 different colleges, never graduated from one, you know, was a true hippie, and someone convinced him that he was really funny and should write TV, and just on a whim came here and was overnight, you know, writing on the old Bob Newhart show and MASH and stuff like that. He was just good at it, you know? And one of the things when I first started working for him, the first DreamWorks TV show was this sitcom called Champs. It wasn't successful and, you know, it didn't really hit or anything. But I was 24 on that show, and the coolest thing about that show was Gary walked into the writer's room early on and he said, hey, I'm glad you're all here. I like all your work. I wasn't doing anybody any favors, but I believe in a meritocracy. I don't care if you're a staff writer or if you're the co-executive producer. If you're good at outlining shows, you're going to stand up in front of everybody and outline shows. And I just saw that as an opportunity to not be afraid. And very early on in that show, I was kind of running the writer's room when he wasn't around.
Describe what that means, running a writer's room.
Meaning if you sit around a table with anywhere from 6, depending on if it's a small show, to 13 other men and women, when you'll see the end credits of a TV show, it'll say staff writer, story editor, executive story editor, co-producer, producer, supervising producer, co-executive producer, executive producer. They are all the same job. Occasionally, someone else will be an executive producer because they've worked their way up there and they help to run the room. Every other title is just writer, but what it means is writer that's been here 1 year, writer that's been here 2 years, writer that's been here 3 years, writer that's been in the business, and it's just a pay scale.
Right.
Okay. Every one of them does the same job. A lot of shows, you'll go in and the people think that those titles are the hierarchy. So someone will maybe correctly in this show say, you know, I'm the co-executive producer. So when those guys are off editing a show, I'm going to run the room in here and outline stories. And in those environments, you know, the staff writer, the 24-year-old who it's his or her first gig, will sit and be quiet. And when the person says, you know, let's hear some jokes, they're standing up. You'll pitch them jokes or this is the story or the way I think it should be. And Gary came in and just announced right off the bat, I don't care what your title is. You know, whatever makes it the best show is going to be great. And so I just went for it, you know, because I've always been kind of vocal and good at breaking down stories and structure and very quickly started kind of outlining and putting stories on the board. And didn't really worry about offending anybody because he had created that environment, and I was luckily good enough at it, you know, that I think he saw something in me. And the other funny thing is we talk about being a mentor, and Gary would say this where he's still here. It is both selfish and selfless to be a mentor in television specifically, and I'll tell you why, because I'm doing this now with some younger men and women that have worked with me for years. So when we did Spin City, we're in New York, and Gary was like, you know, he said, here's how you run a writer's room. You know, I saw you doing it on the last show. You know, you have to be a little more diplomatic, and taught me stuff. And he's like, here's how you talk to actors. Here's how you edit a show. Here's how you deal with the network. And it was so funny. All the while he's like sending me to showrunner camp, I'm like, wow, what a great guy. It's so amazing that he's doing that. It never dawned on me. That show shot in New York, because that's where Mike Fox lived. Mm-hmm. It never dawned on me that Gary never moved his family to New York. You know, what I mean? he had a gorgeous apartment there, but he would like come in, you know, he would be there for like months at a time. And then like 7 months into the first year, he was like, all right, you think you got it? And I was like, yeah, I could totally do this. He's like, all right, I'll see you around. You know, and that's really what mentorship is. You know, he very quickly evolved into he would come in on Thursdays to see like a last rehearsal and then watch the show, you know, on Fridays and then be gone back to his family. And then the second year he was gone.
And do you think there's a leadership quality built into, like, is that a necessity for that kind of thing?
I think you can learn leadership qualities a little bit. I think it's confidence. You know, completely, I always joke about it, I think it's unearned confidence. You know, because it's not just the, it directly translates to leadership, because out here, which is a, you know, business that nobody knows anything, if something's going to work or if it's going to fail, to have the comp, you know, people make fun of me now because if you ask me about any TV show once before it goes on TV, what's going to happen? It's going to be a huge hit. It's going to be on for 8 or 9 years. And if you held a gun to my head and said, do you really believe that? I'd be like, yeah. You know, and then 3 weeks later, it's canceled, you know, and I got a new show. Like, what's going to happen with this one? Oh, it's going to be a monster hit.
So it's not only unearned confidence, it is undeterred confidence.
Yeah, somewhat delusional.
Well, but I mean, you got to believe it if you're going to make someone else believe it.
I used to torture my friends out here by, one friend started a conversation when we were like 22, 21 at the bar. And he's like, what's your life philosophy? Is when you're sitting around with your friends trying to be deep, you know? And someone's like, you know, people are talking about karma and how you treat other people. And they're like, what's your philosophy? I'm like, my life philosophy is everything goes my way. And they're like, yeah, really funny. What do you mean? I'm like, no, I mean it. You know, I mean that I feel like even when bad things happen to me, they're happening for a reason that something better is going to happen to me. And it became a joke because when I got fired off of Friends, Gary Goldberg called me up. And he said, you know, you worked with the person that I've worked with before who said that you play basketball. Gary plays ball, right? And
It all comes back to basketball.
And he said that you're a little kind of brash and cocky and I didn't, he's like, that doesn't bother me. I understand if it bothers other people. And so the fact that I got to create Spin City out of getting fired off of the greatest job, you know, in television at that time. So it gave me a great go to a bar with your buddies, everything goes my way moment.
Well, I mean, look, it's paid off in your work. But, you know, hearing that, too, I feel like you're a really quick study and that, you know, picking the right mentor probably saved you years of slogging through and figuring out certain things. Like, I was curious when you said, you know, here's how you talk to actors. Like, what did someone with that many years in the business, how did he boil that message down to you? What was the message about talking to actors?
Oh, the funniest thing about it was the conversation came about because, and we were trying to, you know, Gary would always put our writer's rooms near a gym where he could play ball. You know, we were trying to get out and play basketball. And Barry Boswick, if he's watching this, it's okay. But Barry Boswick came in and, you know, he said, I don't think, you know, my character is completely fleshed out. And Gary said some great stuff about, you know, that's part of the journey for this TV show. We know exactly where we're going, you know, and you're playing it so well. And if there's things that, you know, you don't know about who the mayor is yet, it's because we don't want you to know them yet. And because we're following you a little bit, you know, and making Barry feel great, you know. And I made the mistake of going, why, what do you think this character is like? And Gary gave me a death look, and literally you could time cut ahead to an hour later when Barry was done talking, you know, and we had missed basketball, and he left. Gary's like, don't ever ask an actor, you know, what they think the character is on a TV show, because if they had a real issue with something specific, they would say, hey, I don't like it that this character is mean to his wife, or I don't like it that this right. character, that she's, you know, hands on her hips and scolding her husband all the time, which happens all the time and completely valid. He said 9 times out of 10, it's an insecure profession that they're coming in to be told that they're doing it right because they want to do well for you. And he's like, don't get them talking, just make them feel better and send them on their way. Otherwise, they will eat up our basketball time. Sounds very cynical. But the real message was, I didn't realize that even with somebody I'd seen for so many years in theater, in movies, like Barry Boswick, is still ultimately looking for, you're doing great. You know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting because really, that relationship has to start with the writing and go to the acting. Yeah. So I would assume the actor has to come to you at some point and say, you know, you have all the information.
Gary had a very specific philosophy with talking to actors regarding performance. He believed in the let's do both of our thing instead of one of us is right and one of us is wrong. And so, and it's been adopted on all my shows. I will always say to every actress, every actor, you do it once the way it's written and with the intention that I heard it in my head and I can tell you how or tell you how it's said. And if you get that, then you can do and or say, you know, your version, even with different words.
Right,
you know, I don't care. And I'm going to earn your trust because after three or four episodes, you'll be watching it on TV and go, wow, it's not a trick. A couple of the times he picked the stuff I did because it's better. I don't care.
I subscribe to that philosophy too. I think the best idea should win. And to think that you're anything but an ensemble, I mean, it, you just
That's
limit
crazy.
All your tools
yeah.
if you don't do that. But to talk about show running a little bit, you said once that the strange thing about being hired to run a show is the job that you were doing to get you hired becomes the job you aren't doing anymore.
That's
once
insane.
You're a showrunner. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, okay. So the weirdest thing about show running and why some people have an acumen for it and some don't is say you're a very good writer and you've written for 5 years on, what's a great show right now? Veep. Show's so good.
Great show.
Unbelievable, man. So say you get to a point that then people are willing to talk to you about, Sam, what do you want to do for your show? Because you're so good. And because you're a great writer, you're like, this is my show, these are the characters, all on your job. This is my show, these are the characters, and this is what the episodes are going to be like, and here's the pilot script. And they're like, great, make it, and you make that one. You know, you direct it yourself, or you hire somebody, or whatever. And then when they decide to pick it up with a show, sometimes people are getting this call for the first time. You know, you're basically told, oh, now you have to be responsible for the budget, for hiring and firing everybody, for the above the line and below the line, for where the dressing rooms are. You have to be a shrink to all these actors. You have to understand the cost differential and how many songs you're going to have versus you know, how many swing sets you're going to build on a weekly basis. You have to have an inherent knowledge of accounting if you don't want to get walked all over by the studio. And when you take all these things into a big pile, where it used to be this huge circle of writing was your whole job, and maybe on some shows a tiny little circle of, hey, sometimes you go into editing, you know, now writing is that little circle.
So you replace yourself, in a sense.
Yeah, and it's only, you have to find a way, it takes you further and further away from why you got into the job in the first place. You know, I remember the moment it hit me is the worst is I was in a long meeting while a script was being punched up that was going to shoot the next night, and the meeting was about the car services that the writers were taking home from Chelsea Pier, you know, after late night rewrites, and whether or not we could save money from the budget if we just had a van or gave everybody a stipend for a cab. And I was just like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, this is not why I wanted to write jokes. And I'm literally going like, how much is it if two people go with the car service, you know?
That begs the question of, with all the jobs that a showrunner really encompasses, from directing, producing, writing, managing, accounting, producing, you know, if you only could really do one, what it most naturally fits and is most enjoyable to you about that job?
I always think first of what I'd give up. I don't like the being a shrink part, though I think it's made me a better parent. You know, you suddenly, if you're a person that's not emotionally engaged all the time with people you aren't super tight with, it's a weird job that you find yourself involved in other people's emotional lives. You know, the joke on Scrubs when it ended after 9 years was, by the end of the last year, every writer but one had cried in my office. You know, and by the way, and I used to subconsciously, not knowing it, build a barrier between me and them while they were talking. So if you were sitting on the other side of my desk, I'd be like, no, I understand. You know, I was just doing
Eddie's scripts.
Kid to just at the end be, no, I understand why you're sad. But there's two things. Writing, obviously, the best thing about writing is I always feel for actors because you can't be a struggling actor or actress and say, yeah, I'm going to go home and act a little tonight. You know what I mean? Just to feel, it's still at the end of the day, I can go write a scene, a sketch, a bunch of jokes, a play. By the way, you can take it to another state. You can take it on a trip with your kids. You know what I mean? It never leaves you. And it is a tool you have in your pocket that you have the thought in the back of your head all the time that I can redefine myself with a drop of a hat. I love it. You know, I love, my friends ask me sometimes to write letters for them, you know, if it's trying to get a kid into school. You know, I love writing toasts. I love, you know, I love sitting with a blank pad. It's still, I still write in yellow pads, and I can I can disappear into it. That is a gift, because think if you're an actor or a musician, you know, someone can take the job away from you, you know, and no one can take being a writer away from me. So I like that. The only other thing I'm going to miss, I had no idea how much I would enjoy editing.
Okay. Really?
Yeah, because I love how you can, you know, Rush Hour is a show we did this year, and in one day we were completely able to change the tone of it and the entire story into something that we knew the network wanted more and something we liked more, and that was fascinating to me, you know, because we had two comics in the show, and I'm a comedy writer, and the first cut of it was over-the-top joke. You would say, oh, it's an hour-long comedy, you know, and someone close to me said, you know, CBS is going to want it to be an hour-long drama with comedy in it. And to actually go back and go, no big deal, and look at it and go, that was easy, you know, just and have it be completely different.
Really, a great editor is as strong a storyteller than any director or writer.
I did not realize that until I got deep into the television business that, you know, you look at these amazing, it's why you look at these amazing directors that you and I, you know, have admired forever, and that they have long-term relationships with editors, because, you know, one of the things you find out early is that an editor that can give you an editor's cut that you could probably put out as a feature or put on television is a rarity, and it means that you're right, that they're a storyteller in their own right.
You know? That's right, that's right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about pitching and the idea that, you know, I'll tell you a funny story that you may not remember, but I was over at your house one day. My kids were swimming with your kids, and your wife and I were having a glass of wine, having a great time, and then you showed up, and you had just come back from pitching Cougar Town. or you just come back from the meeting where they said, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And you weren't completely happy about it.
No,
you were
no.
sort of like, oh, they bought it. They want us to do it. And first off, let's start at the beginning. Obviously, you got to sit around, you got to spitball ideas until something feels like it's got enough meat on it to be able to turn into a story. But for you, what does it take to get something to the point where you feel like you can take it out in the world?
It depends on the project, because quite honestly, you know if you have, say, an actor and a high concept attached, that you probably don't need that much, you know, which is, you know, probably not the way it should be, but it's no different in the feature business. If you're like, hey, this is an action movie and Tom Cruise.
Snakes on a Plane.
There you go, right? Snakes on a Plane and Sam Jackson's in it. Oh, yeah, yeah, we'll do that. And if you're doing a more, you know, Scrubs was rough to pitch, because, you know, part of my pitch was, you know, I'd always start by going, in American television, we truly like our doctors to be very serious people that kick open doors and say stat a lot, you know, and are doing a lot of this to people. and I said, my best friend, from college, who was just an absolute goofball screw-up, decided late that he was going to become a doctor. And I always joke that my worst nightmare is to wake up in an emergency room and see that clown going, hey, you're going to be fine. You know what I mean? And I said, and that's the show, because he's a great guy because he cares so much. You know, and trying to sell a show with nobody attached that's personal and that's an idea, I would always try to come up with just a bigger and longer sell.
Is it almost like you have to convince someone that your idea is new and different, and almost like hooking them in on something, but then really, once you sell it, it's about executing something?
It is. You know what? I believe that people respond to personal stories. And so one of the pieces of advice I give young writers is no matter what your story is, if you can attach it to something that really personally happened to you or why it has personal resonance to you, you know, or why there's an emotional hook and that it seems real. Because I think the pitches that always die are the ones that someone comes in and goes, wouldn't it be interesting if this thing that never happened to me was in a world with these characters that I've never met? You know, you could sense it. And I get pitched to a lot. I certainly don't think you have to let everybody know what it is you're planning on doing. You know what I mean? Completely. I try to sell, try to make people laugh. I hope that sometimes it's about the story itself, but more often than not, they don't realize that I'm making them laugh independently of the story that I'm telling them. And I try to stay very general, because I often believe that we are in a business that if you get too specific, you're giving people more things to be scared of and to not like.
Right. You know, there's that funny thought of, and I think I first learned about it on a Seinfeld episode, which is when George landed a good line, he immediately exited the room.
Yeah.
And the idea that you know, once someone has sort of said yes, get out of there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, dude, don't talk yourself into a no. The somebody who I work with now will make you laugh. His name's Jeff Ingold, and he runs my company, and he ran Comedy at NBC for years and years. And he said, the only negative thing that was ever said about you after a pitch was that I came in and I sold them some pilot. And we're friends, but he was the only one after I left. He was like, we just bought his show. He pitched nothing. You know, I came in, I talked a little bit about fathers and sons and told one story about my dad and I. We were close in age, you know, and then got other people talking about their dads and did a couple jokes about, you know, what it's like having a very young father. And then when they're like, yeah, this sounds like a great area, we want to do this, and I got out of there. And Jeff was like the only one that was like, I think he just said fathers and sons, and we bought his show. You know, not really sure.
But that's the art, right?
Not really sure what we're doing.
That's an art form in itself.
Can I tell you the soul-crushing thing that still exists? It's a show that's on right now. I hope it this makes you laugh, but this is for everybody. It still is what you have to acknowledge, the cliche of it's show business, right? So I was in with the head of my studio, with Jeff Ingold was with me, and he wanted to know what I was working on. And I had an idea going around in my head about my mom's family. My mom was the first one in her family to go to college, and it was very small town, and they're fishing guides on the St. John's River in real life. And I hadn't really worked it out yet, but I was talking with the studio head and pitching him through the idea. And he was grinding me, as he should, you know, but he was, you know, I don't think this is universal enough for network TV. Is this character relatable? Who's the hero? Who are we gonna like? And he's just pounding me on it. And at the end of an hour, he said, you know, maybe there's something here, but you're not there yet, right? And I'm like, oh, gosh. And we're walking out, and Jeff Ingold takes out of his back pocket a book called Undateable. And the book Undateable was just a book that says undateable on the front, and then it has 150 pictures of guys that are undateable. It says, like, fanny pack guy.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Goatee guy, right? And he takes that book out, and he throws it to the studio head. He's like, you see this book? And the studio head picks it up. He goes, undateable. It's a great title. He goes, fanny pack guy. Goatee guy. I hate that guy. Yeah, we'll make this. And that was it. And I'm like, I almost lost my mind, because they're both friends of mine. I'm like, I've been in here talking to you for an hour about a personal show.
Right.
That just happened in 8 seconds. I'm like, I don't even know what Undateable is about. He's like, go figure it out. It's a good title. It's funny. And that show's on TV now.
But it also, you know, it kind of shows that idea that it really is about the execution. Like, you got a great title, you can market it, and then in the end, you put a successful group of people together and a successful showrunner. And I mean, you said once that you could have called Friends Undateable.
Sure. Wish I could call Undateable Friends Part 2, man. It would be crushing right now. But the you sprawled
well,
up
people
something.
Should know that's your show too.
Oh, Undateable, yeah. Well, that's me getting to mentor someone else. He's a good young writer, and we did it together, and he's killing it. I got to call him today and say, hey, I was thinking of talking to my friend Sam today instead of coming to the writer's room. And he's so mad. He's like, of course it's on Friday. But you said something that is so important to me, and it's a message I always try to put out when we talk about television, that TV is about execution. And why that matters is the life of every TV showrunner and show creator, their friends, family, other people that aren't not necessarily into the industry will come up to them and go, hey, our office should be a sitcom. Our office is so funny, it should be a sitcom. Or I have this great idea for you. It's about, I had this moment with Sarah Chalk, and she won't mind me saying it. She came up to me early on and she said, I have this great idea for a television show. It's really cool. My parents ran an adoption agency out of our house. So I always had different brothers and sisters, you know, for weeks at a time. And then they would be gone and placed in, you know, other places. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I'm like, do you want to write that? You should write it. You know, and she's like, no, I don't want to write it. I was thinking that you could write it, you know, and then I'd own part of it, which is what people think when they send you ideas. And I love Sarah, and she's a family friend. So I said, here's what we're going to do. First, let's go to the Writers Guild, and we'll see how many adoption agency scripts are registered. You know, there's always 50 to 100. You know, there's always, every idea has been written 1,000 times.
That's an interesting way to put that.
Okay, right? So that's number one. I said, number two, when you're a showrunner, what you've done is you've worked really hard your whole life and career to get to a point that you can go do your own ideas, you know, and that you're finally somewhere that you can sit in a room and go, here's the idea that I want to do. So when someone like that is coming to you, what they're saying is, hey, instead of doing your own idea, which you would own 100% of, I want you to do my idea, even though you probably have 100 of your own ideas, and not own 100% of it, even though you still do all the work. You know, and no one out in the world understands that. But, you know, ideas are cheap. Execution is the deal. Got it.
Right, right. Well, okay, talking about that world of, you know, coming up with an idea and navigating it through a pitch and onto the next stage, which would be a pilot. Because to me, the whole idea of pilot season, it's kind of like a record company. And they, you know, when record companies were flush with cash, the idea was, well, sign 20 bands, and if one of them makes it, they'll pay for the 19 mistakes we made.
Yeah. Together,
right? And I feel like a good example of that would be your show, Nobody's Watching. Which, okay, so it's two guys in Ohio who love TV, and I saw a parallel right there. You love classic American multicam television with a live audience. And they, you pretty much slam all the shows you don't like in the first 10 seconds.
Of made like 1,000 enemies.
Right. And the idea being these kids send a tape out to all the network executives saying, hey, your show sucked this season. We can do a better job. Hire us. And the show becomes a reality show about two guys trying to create a sitcom, but they live on the set with the live audience. And it's so meta. And it's so like inside the world of television.
Yeah.
And I'm sure so many parallels to your personal story.
Yeah. You know what? The metaphor you made was great, because except for one thing. You know how record companies say, hey, we'll go... we'll pick these 10 bands, and if one of them makes it, it's going to be great. The only difference would be with the pilot thing is but there's also only two lead guitarists in the world, you know, and so hopefully the right band will get the right, because all these shows, including the dramas, all trying to cast their shows at the exact same time, and that's why it's screwy, you know, because for a TV show to get on television, there has to be some weird convalescence of timing, a good script, with perfect casting falling in your lap, with there being no other shows like that show on that network, with them having a time slot that's not only a good time slot, but that the lead-in has the same type of audience breakdown that would like your show, and all these things have to coalesce and happen. And it shouldn't be happening at the same time. You know, it should be, you know, the first thing that would free up the whole pilot process would be any time of year you go around, and when you have it, you can still cast it from whoever's available. But the problem is it's all built backing up from something that still exists called the upfronts, which are ad sales.
Right.
And which is when every network takes their wares, you know, as if they're going to a country market, you know, and says, who's going to buy advertising on these shows? And since they all need to still be done at that simultaneous time, they're all made at the same time. And it is insane and almost impossible to do.
The landscape of television is changing so much that I wonder if that system is behind the viewing habits of what people are doing. And if
it is. It's very interesting. You can read in lots of magazines, oh, TV is dying, in some of them. You know, but what they really mean is there's more content than ever. There's more people are watching, you know, statistically, more people are watching more content, more TV than ever. You know, I watch TV voraciously, but I certainly watch it my own way. I have my own schedule. You know, I don't have a lot of, I do live viewing for sports, but otherwise, you know, I watch it when it works with my family and my
wife. Sure. Well, it's interesting because I feel like no one really could tell you how it's going to shake out, how we're going to watch TV in 5 years.
No.
How do you handle that sort of thing, being someone who's played in the network field your entire life?
The biggest change is, for me, the thought of coming up with a show that has universal appeal across ethnicity, economic bracket, that's kind of gone. You know what I mean? Because
right.
I think that in network TV, as recently as 5 years ago, you would be, you know, when you're sitting around with nothing, with a blank piece of paper, you would say, what is a show in a world and characters I can come up with? This is a network that'll appeal to everyone. You know, that I mean, that it, you know, and the reality for me is even the shows like that, it's a good example. Oh, Modern Family is like that, and it will be worth a lot of money. That being said, Modern Family's ratings as recently as 10 years ago would not have it in the top 50 shows. You know what I mean? Because we've gotten so, you know, once my dad has 120 channels and he's telling me one of his favorite shows is on Bravo, you know, I'm like, all right, the wheels are off. Right? You know what I mean? He's like, you're bothered. I'm watching something called Vikings on the History Channel. I'm like, who are you? What are you doing?
And you're like, my show's on right now.
Yeah, so that, yeah. What's your show? So that, by the way, that means that's what's really changed, especially from the comedy side, is I was in meetings in my early 30s where they would say, this is funny and we like it, but this, you know, this doesn't have mass appeal, you know, which is what, on some level, why you see the feature film shift to being like, oh, it's a huge superhero movie with lots of special, you know, because they're trying to find mass appeal still. TV in networks, even networks are letting go in the last few years especially, you know, as the playing field's leveled. You see shows like The Last Man on Earth on mm-hmm. Fox, you know, shows that you would have 5 or 6 years ago, if you try to pitch that, someone would be like, oh, it's a cable show. You know, what are you doing? Where it used to be, you know, I grew up loving TV. Every hit show was a show that everyone watched. You know, everyone watched MASH. You know what I mean? Everyone watched Cheers. Everyone watched Seinfeld.
Well, that's the thing. I think that there was mass appeal and there was more of a community feel in sitting around and watching MASH. And, you know, is that era over?
The only thing that's really gone is financial, you know, because I think you used to sit around and go, man, if I could find my own Seinfeld or my own Modern Family or my own Big Bang, I can, you know, the money from those shows could literally change the world, you know? I mean,
sure.
I'm not exaggerating, you know? And hey, as young people, we're all dreamers, and it used to be when I got into the business, there were so many people hitting those cash cows, man, and because, you know, you would watch a sitcom like Cheers or Seinfeld or Friends, everybody would watch it while I was on TV, and then within 2 years it would be on at 7 o'clock and 11 o'clock on every single channel.
That's right.
Filling space because there was not enough content. In everything but financial terms, it's very exciting that we've entered a world that you can go, I'm incredibly interested in this extremely specific, odd, maybe small, whether it's transparent, you know, whether it's transgender or motorcycle gangs, you know,
right.
Anarchy, or
right.
and that someone out there is going to say, there's an audience for that, and we'll pay to make that. The upside or downside, if you however you choose to see it, is that the giant pot of gold is no longer at the end of that rainbow. It's like music. If you're here doing it, you're here doing it because you would probably do it for free.
Right. But it's interesting to see that fragmenting where it's not a community experience anymore.
No,
you have
it's
these
not
little
at all.
Factions. And
I think the next evolution will be, in a good way, for creators. The more and more niche these things get, the less and less need there will truly be for a giant studio presence. And what I think is going to happen, which could be cool, is we're going to enter an era that people can kind of brand and distribute themselves.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, where Trey and Matt, the guys that did South Park, you know, and it's a studio show and all that stuff, if they did it today with that type of financial backing and came up with that cartoon, that would not be on TV. That would just be, hey, if you like this and you want to order 20 of them, you just click here for $15.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And no studio, no profit shares other than them. It's their product. They put it out. I like the potential for that. That's why you see kind of the studios and everybody scrambling, because it's leaving
right.
the control of it.
Well, my last question involves that voice in your head, because I feel like all artists, they clock themselves at a place in time based upon who they look up to. Is there a hero in your head that you say, oh, okay, so-and-so would think that's funny? Like, do you have that sort of idea that you check in with?
I idolized, probably oddly, because it started young, a guy named Larry Gelbart. And what I thought was fascinating about him, not a lot of people know this, but he he could go across any lines, and right now you still exist in a world that, oh, you're a TV comedy writer, oh, you're a feature writer, oh, you're a drummer. You know, Larry Gelbart wrote Tootsie. He created MASH. He wrote, you know, dramatic HBO movies, Barbarians at the Gate. He did City of Angels, you know, the Broadway musicals. And the funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. He's like one of those guys that got nominated for a Tony, an Oscar, an Emmy, and, you know, and just all he ever did was write, you know. And so to me, look, I'm a comedian in my head and heart first. When I write a funny joke, I still get the same, you know, pride out of it that I did when I was 20, you know, of writing something like, oh, that's funny, man. You know, that's a good turn of phrase, or that's a funny gag. But I still, in a cool way driving me, have a hero. You know, he's passed away, but I have on my desk, he gave me a MASH DVD box. It's the only time I met him. And someone told him he was like my idol. And he signed a note to me of like, way to keep the drama comedy mix alive, because he liked Scrubs. And so for me to have someone that I can still aspire to do what he did and haven't come close, you know what I mean, is kind of the bar by which I judge. It's why I'm trying to do an hour-long drama this year. It's why I try to go do things like stand-up, even though I'm a comedy writer. It's why, you know, we're trying to write a Broadway musical out of Scrubs. Other than that, the weirdest, most surreal experience for me was to grow up worshiping Michael J. Fox as a young guy that saw Back to the Future and Family Ties, and then overnight be writing jokes for him. So much so that the weird, I not only will have moments that I go, Mike would think that was funny, I still write jokes that don't work, that they would work if Michael J. Fox said them. Because, you know, I had them in my head as a kid, and then for, you know, years on Spin City, you know?
That's so interesting.
Yeah, you know, so I can hear his rhythms, and he had Jack Benny-like timing, you know, as a guy in front of a live audience. He was so funny, man. And change like C-plus joke into an A. And that's the one thing I have to be careful about, is having moments like with the talented actors and actresses in their own right who do their own thing, where in my brain I'm going, Mike would have killed that joke, and we'll write something new, you know?
Which you never tell them, I hope.
No. This is the meanest thing you could be. I worked with this one guy that would have slayed that joke. We'll just cut it.
Is funny.
I would never do that.
In the hands of the right person.
I would never do it.
Well, listen, it's, you know, I'm always attracted to the work that's being done by people who are restless and who don't want to do the same thing over and over again. And I think you know, knowing you personally, but also watching what you're doing, it's inspiring, and it's great to kind of get inside your head a little bit.
Oh, thanks, man. It was fun to actually talk and pontificate about it. I really appreciate it. You know, I'll jump at any opportunity to talk about myself. So if you want to do it after the cameras are off, I'm game, man.
Oh, we can just sit here. Thank you for doing this.
You bet. It was a blast.
Hey folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full Off Camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Off Camera Show or me at Sam Jones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. And while you're there, take a minute on iTunes and give us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. And join me next time when I sit down with actress Linda Cardellini.
When you come to LA and you want to be an actor, the only real thing you have to offer is yourself. All along as you're growing up, you're like, there must be one way to do this. And you keep learning time and time again that it's not. It's incredibly personal.
Linda has been on my guest wish list for a long time. I've been a fan of her work on the now iconic Freaks and Geeks for years, and I was curious to know how that journey started for her. And for someone who didn't know how to get into acting, she's done pretty well for herself since then, going on to multiple film and TV projects like ER, Return, Mad Men, and Bloodline. In this episode, we discuss those roles, the benefits of delayed puberty, and why she may be doomed to spend eternity in a prairie dress. See you next time, off camera.